few weeks ago, I was listening to the Petapixel podcast, and they were talking about Affinity's apps disappearing from app stores, and how this is probably the outcome of Canva's purchase of them a little while ago, and how it's a shame, and how it means consolidation in the marketplace, And on that basis and that evidence, they weren't wrong. It does seem bad. We need more players in the marketplace, whatever that marketplace is, not fewer. But actually what turned out was that Affinity and Canva were doing something crazy. They were taking their suite of applications and combining those down from multiple applications into one. One app that kind of combines pixel editing and vector editing and layout all into one package. Friend of the show, Dan Rubin, was on last week talking about the book that he made with AJ Woomer. And if you've not listened, you should go back and listen to that episode. It's a lovely conversation. But Dan also let me know, with permission from Affinity ahead of time, that he'd been using the new software to make the book, and then suggested it might be fun to come on and talk about that with you all. So last week, ahead of the announcement on the 30th, we got together and recorded and spoke about the new software, what he'd used it for, what it meant, and kind of software in general. You'll hear us start by bemoaning some of the changes to the most recent version of macOS.
I feel like that's what I see multiple times a day on iOS 26, less so on macOS 26.
Right.
Because there's thankfully less liquid glass everywhere in, you know, like you're using StreamYard on the web, you know, liquid glass just doesn't exist. It isn't there. But where it is, like whenever I have to go into settings, like I just the tiny little interactions of the buttons, I miss the high degree of responsiveness that existed in the previous just UI elements. The liquid glass, it's my biggest frustration with it is that because they've added all these animations that they are very proud of, and as I've seen this happen for decades in animations for screen, if they're done for the sake of patting themselves on the back, and I know they don't think that, but it's like, okay, so well, whoever's approving this needs to see how cool the animation is, it ends up being too much and too slow. And that means the software feels slow. And that little button in all settings on iOS, and then they ported to macOS, that was just like it switches from green to gray, and it's just a circle that slides across. There was nothing to it. There was nothing to show off. So it happened instantaneously. And even the one place that I see that in macOS 26 is in the main menu bar up at the top of the screen. It's like that feels slow now. It never felt slow. It hasn't felt slow to me, even when it when Apple introduced macOS originally and Aqua, and they were doing, you know, building something on Unix for the first time, doing all sorts of heavy lifting. It didn't feel slow, and that really upsets me. I mean, this is potentially a nice segue into the discussion of using new software, using untested software, using software that hasn't necessarily even been released all the time.
And then the madness of using that software to create a book, which is legendarily always a straightforward process that always runs completely smoothly. So for listeners, we spoke last week with AJ on the call as well, and we were chatting about the book and where some of those ideas came from and maybe where he's going next with his photography. But Dan, you mentioned to me the potential for that there'd be an interesting follow-up because you've been allowed to tinker with Affinity's new tool, which as of recording is not announced, but as of release of this episode will be. So talk to us a bit about how that came about and how, because I think we all, the world is enjoying kicking Adobe right now, like every 5 minutes. And I feel like a bomb is about to go off for them and they may or may not know yet. But talk to me about how that got started and kind of what that experience has been like, because it feels like you must have enjoyed it if you were going to take the risk of producing the book using this software as well.
Well, the risk, I think, is a good place to start this conversation, because I've used a lot of different software over the years for doing print design. Starting with Aldus PageMaker. So for anyone who is old enough to know what that is. That also ages me. That was my first experience of desktop publishing, which is what it was really called back then. And page layout was Aldus PageMaker. And I've gone through that, like the iterations and the different software, you know, Quark Express, I used that for many years. And then when Adobe introduced InDesign, it answered so many little questions and frustrations that I and everyone else really had with Quark Express at the time, that even though it was untested in the market, it was new software and it did a lot of things typographically really well, which excited me, and I started using that. And then I've used, you know, mixtures of software, mostly Adobe, now for the last, say, 20 years to produce things for print. Because you move away from using Freehand back in the day to using Illustrator. Software gets acquired and then sunsetted unceremoniously. Usually we've lost a lot of good software over the years, and that's kind of the situation where we've been in for a while now. Now I've known about Affinity's software, publisher, designer, and I'm forgetting the other one.
Isn't it Affinity Photo?
Photo, yes, obviously. But I haven't used, well, and this is why I don't really know them that well, because I've not really had enough of a need to use them, right? I know that's not the same for everyone else, but I've been a fan of them because of how they've been built. I love fast software. I love software that is built the way software should be, with optimization at its heart and with speed at its heart. And there's a lot of software like that out in the world that I really like, but I don't need to use, but I can still be a fan of. And being so embedded for so many years in the Adobe world, for comparison, even though I've used, you know, I was using Quark Express at the time for page layout, I used Photoshop for the first time at 2.0. Like, I've been using Photoshop a long time. And you get very familiar with the tools. You start not having to think about the tools or the keyboard shortcuts, or you can move very, very quickly and very fluidly. And when you're in flow in the creative process, using a tool that's an extension of you, you don't have to think about, ultimate importance. So the idea of using software I don't have to use, even if it's better, has never really appealed to me. I like testing things, I like trying things out, but that's why I hadn't really fallen into the Affinity universe, even though I was very aware of Serif, the company behind them, for a long time. Fast forward to the beginning of this year, and a good friend of mine, Peter Neal, who has been an Affinity fan for a long time and has worked closely with them on various projects, he was actually down in Margate visiting me, and he was showing me stuff on Affinity on his iPad, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. I kind of knew it was there, but I'd never seen it running, and it was much better. It was like desktop quality software, and it was really cool. And he kind of was encouraging me in that conversation. He's like, "Oh, you should really use it. You should try this stuff." I'm like, "All right, I'll give it a try. I'll see if there's a project I can use it on." And there wasn't really in the first couple of months of the year. I knew this book was coming, but I, you know, we hadn't started looking at actual layout and putting pixels and, you know, a vector to paper, as it were. And then I had another conversation around the photography show with Peter. In person, I think we were chatting about various things, and he kind of alluded to the fact that he wanted to introduce me to the Affinity team to become a beta tester. And obviously he didn't say much, but he was like, yeah, I think you'll really like what they're working on. I'll introduce you. And so he did introduce me, and I started having conversations with the Affinity folks. And me, whenever I have the opportunity to try something for the first time and there feels like there's meaning behind it. Like, if I'm beta testing software, like for the listeners who don't know, I was one of the original beta testers of Instagram before it launched. And I've had the opportunity to beta test a lot of really cool apps, desktop and iOS, and even some Android. I like testing them properly. If I'm going to say yes to testing something, I can't just tinker with it, because that's not useful testing. I need to find real world reasons to test it. So being introduced to the Affinity team to become a beta tester started me thinking, what can I make with this stuff that will be meaningful, that will be real? what will force me to test it properly, to really push at the edges, to find out where it works or doesn't work, to find out where it doesn't work for me, but it might work for other people, but maybe there's a way to change the language or the interface elements or whatever. And because I can talk about this now, what was very quickly apparent once I'd signed the relevant NDAs was that the new Affinity was not going to be three apps, it was going to be one, which initially worried me because I initially thought bloat. Those worries were erased the first time I had a beta build because it was just so fast that I thought, okay, this hasn't even gone through proper optimization yet for production, and it's still great, which is really exciting. And then immediately I thought, well, I know the project that's coming up that is would be risky enough to use beta software on because you never know what could go wrong, but low risk enough because it's a project I'm kind of co-owner of that I can justify accepting that risk. And that was AJ's book. And I went to AJ and just kind of said, I can't really tell you everything about this, but I'm just letting you know, I'm going to take this little risk here because I think it's going to be worthwhile for us. And equally to Affinity, I said, I'm in the Adobe universe. I've never actually used Affinity software before. This is not just an opportunity to beta test and really stress test this software for a deep, decades-long Adobe user, but it's also an opportunity to make something that has to ship for the first time. And you only get one chance at that. And so I also floated the idea past Affinity, and they were very receptive to it. They have a great community team, as I found out, where I basically said, look, you don't have to do this, but I think there's a case study in here. I think because we're talking about this before I've started, I can document the process of making this book. And it's not just making this book in this new software. It's making this book in this new software as someone who has never used the Affinity software language before, coming from an Adobe background. And I think it would be a really neat thing to capture, because if you believe in your software as much as you seem to, this will be a good story. This will end up being a really positive case study in the end. And they were obviously very excited about that opportunity because they realized it can only happen one time. And they said yes, and they very kindly offered support as well towards the printing and production of this book, which for a fine art book, everyone knows that is the biggest struggle, to do something right, to use the right materials, to have the right printing press. And so that began my journey of using software I'd never used before to make a thing that had to be made. And it's really interesting because there are so many interface patterns in the world, and I'm also an interface and product designer. That is my kind of longest professional background. So I look very critically at the decisions that are made, and there are a lot of things that are done in the Affinity universe language-wise that are borrowed from the patterns that Adobe has established over the years. It would be silly not to in a big way, because you can't get people to move software without some level of familiarity. And I think they've done a really good job of figuring out where it has to be familiar. Even if they think there's a better way of doing it, the better way would break people transferring over. And then ways that it doesn't have to be familiar because they're finding a better way to do it, a better way to explain something, a better way visually or in their language. So I probably had in the first month of starting to lay out the book, it was also, you know, setting a grid system, trying to figure out, you know, where type needed to be included in the book, and you know, even though it was very minimal, how to approach that, you know, simple things, how things that I would do without thinking in the InDesign universe that I had to actually think about. And once I got past some of those little initial hiccups of just translating where this is, what menu hides this thing, what thing I can do that I couldn't do before, so I now have to add that to my thought process, it became really seamless. So I was using this software from, I guess, about July, August, September was the proper layout sequencing in the layout typesetting. Even the nuances that anyone who's designed a book, you know, it's not necessarily the most complicated, but how do you set up the files to be able to deliver to the printers? For people who aren't familiar with how that process works, most printing presses are now in a full InDesign flow where you can export a package, it's called, from InDesign, and then just send that package, which is the specs, the files themselves, and then any assets that are referenced in those files. And you just send all of that to the printer, and they can open it up in their copy of InDesign and do a pre-flight on their end, which I also would do on my end. That's the industry standard accepted thing. 20 plus years ago, when InDesign wasn't a thing and Quark was a thing, the same thing existed as a process for Quark. And when InDesign was new, you couldn't send an InDesign package to a printer because they didn't have InDesign. It took years for that to change over, but then it did. Right now, we're in that same world where printing presses don't have Affinity. I think that's going to change, especially with Affinity being free, which is a major, major plot point here, is that it's not just three apps in one that also work better than you could ever imagine that they could work because of how slow a lot of software is, but it's also that it's free, which means that for these printing presses, for pre-press departments, for anyone really, there's no reason to not add that software to your arsenal now. That doesn't add a cost, it just earns it like a learning curve. And I think that's going to mean that the landscape changes a lot more rapidly. But in this case, I couldn't have that on the other end because we were sending files to the printer well before the release date of this new software. So I also needed to learn and test and trust whether a different output method than I'd ever had to use. I basically had to send press-ready PDFs to the printing press, which I have done for things like printing from Moo, right? Or from presses that, you know, that aren't really full printing presses where you'd have the full workflow and conversation with them. You know, you output PDFs all the time. It's great. It's fine. But outputting press-ready PDFs from beta software that have to work on the other end, a little nerve-wracking, but they did work. We went through a short round of testing, and everything looked fine on their end, so they didn't question it. They did kind of question, well, why aren't you sending InDesign files? And at the time, I just had to say, well, I'm using Affinity Publisher, the previous single standalone app for page layout. And they just went, oh, yes, well, just send us PDFs. And that was it. The important thing was, though, it worked. The pre-flight process worked. Everything that needed to work in my checklist of output worked. So really, it came down to getting used to new software, hoping it didn't crash. And there were crashes. I'm just going to say that this is pre-release software. You get a new beta maybe every 2 weeks on average externally, where they're doing loads of betas and alphas internally. But those crashes were never terminal. They were never catastrophic. Actually, the first one that happened was in the middle of me. I think I just imported all of the images, kind of the near final images that AJ had scanned in the dark room and then retouched. And so, you know, you're talking a 304-page book with almost 300 placed images in it. And it was a bit of a stress test. And they were all linked images. And it just, one day, I was changing something and just the app disappeared. And I went, when did I last save? Was there an autosave? I haven't tested this part of what this new app does. And I opened it and it actually had autosaved a version. It said, you know, we've got a recovery file. Do you want to recover? I said, well, yeah, let's see how it recovered. I didn't lose a single thing. And even that builds so much confidence because I've had the opposite happen where I have had a catastrophic crash and had to redo hours of work. And even on a very classic design that we had for this book, where it's white space, there is a very intentional grid throughout the book, but I'm not trying to do any super heavy lifting with anything. It still needs to just work. That's almost a better stress test. You almost expect even shipping well-established software to sometimes crash or have problems or slow down when you're throwing a lot at it. When you're doing something that you want to be an everyday kind of process, that's really where the software shows how much it can handle it and how quickly it can do it and how little stress it adds to your work. And what I found especially was, and this was where it really started to shine and where I got excited about it, because beta testing isn't always exciting. It's like taxes. Right. It's interesting, but it's not always exciting. And when you know it has to be production ready, it's also a little nerve wracking. But then I reached, in the later stages of the process, I reached steps where I would normally, even with a linked file, I would have to switch to another app, make edits to like the images, adjust the white balance, adjust, you know, make some tweaks to an image, and then you refresh you know, you update the link, right? That's a normal process for anyone who's ever worked with link files in Illustrator and InDesign or in Affinity. It just worked, but also it worked without having to change apps. You could select an image, an embedded image, a placed image, and decide you wanted to edit some aspect of that image. And it is intelligently able to understand that it's just opening, it's reading the linked file, and the interface just changes into the photo editing interface instantaneously. And it's hard to explain. Anyone who hasn't yet downloaded this new Affinity and tried it, it's hard to understand exactly how seamless that can be. And that is exciting. So if you haven't tried this, do something, you know, download the app, place an image in a layout, and then click the buttons that allow you to fully edit that image. And you'll grin a little bit if you've ever had to do the longer way. And this is what's really, there are a lot of other things that I could talk about that I know the app is capable of that I didn't really need on this project in particular. Things like masking, the way it handles masking and layers, and the fact that that bridges the gap between vector, pixel, and layout is really cool, because it's stuff that you would have to do in separate apps previously, but now you just don't. You can experiment in one place, and you can mask a vector with a pixel with pixel art, or you can invert that really quickly. There's lots of drag and drop interaction and ordering of elements within layers, and the way that layers work a little bit more like groups, but in a different way, that are really exciting, and everything being live updating, especially if you layer filters and everything else. I know I'm firing a whole lot of stuff at you with this, but hopefully this communicates kind of the level of excitement for me, because even though I'm sure you might have some questions here, what happened for me was that with very few exceptions in that entire process, it just worked. And for pre-release software, pre-release by months, that every 2 weeks, the updates were getting better and better and better. And sometimes things were manifestly changing in the interface. And I was providing feedback throughout as well, just saying, this thing did not work the way I expected it to. And here's how I expect it to. And here's why I think you should do that. And the number of times that was listened to, and there was also, it created a dialogue as well. It's really, really nice to have that kind of feedback loop with the people building the software, because it shows that they care deeply. This is a big swing, I think, for Affinity and for Canva, the parent company now. And it's the kind of big swing you can only make once. And big swing, I know, is a baseball metaphor, and I'm not even that big a fan of baseball, and this is an international audience, but you get the idea. You make the big move, the big gamble, the big risk. You can only do that once. It has to work. And what I've seen so far using this software before it is officially released is that they are putting absolutely everything they can into making it work. And that's really exciting as well, because we need competition in the market. There need to be other options, but there need to be options that involve people not having to pay an arm and a leg for their software. And I know that's really tough. And I grew up in the time of shareware, right? Where you could get software that one person had made and you could just use it. And the promise was that if you used it and liked it, you would pay for it later. And I'm not sure I would have gotten into a lot of the design, both in tech and in print. I wouldn't have gotten into this space if there hadn't been certain tools available for me 30 years ago to use in that way. And even though there are, you know, a lot of the competitive landscape exists, there are free apps like GIMP that are, you know, you can use instead of Photoshop, right? It doesn't mean that they're as accessible as a polished app. And it's a really tough thing, right? A commercial company needs to make money. They have to charge for it. There's a lot of tension involved there. There are student discounts for a lot of software, but not all students can afford that. Not everyone is officially a student with an ID, even if they're learning. How do you... It's a big question that I struggle with as a teacher in my career of the creative arts, is how can you teach students? How can you answer the question of a 16-year-old, which is how old I was when I started learning design? How can you answer the question of a 16-year-old right now to say, well, I really want to get into all of these things, but I, you know, my, like, I don't even have a part-time job to afford to pay for that. And the part-time job wouldn't actually even pay for that because it pays for my mobile phone allowance, right? Like, and that's, I think it's really important to state that what Canva has decided to do with Affinity and releasing it for free, it is clearly a really good marketing move, but I think it's actually going to have a meaningful impact on how many people can start making creative output at a professional top tier level because they now have access for free, as long as they have a computer that will run it, right? Which is still an accessibility limit, but they will be able to access it. And I think ultimately that's something that needs to continue happening. And I hope it works for them, because it's been so exciting to actually see that this is possible and to have made a thing. And I actually asked the folks at Affinity, I said, oh, well, you know, I don't know how many other people are testing this and what projects they're working on. Like, you know, like, is there a chance this might be like the first book that's published with the new software? And they're like, oh, no, absolutely. You're the only person who's doing a book with this. There's lots of other creative things happening with this software. So it's also really cool to be the first thing in its category. This book is the first book published using the new Affinity software. And that's, we're the only ones who can say that, which is really cool, because it doesn't really matter to people who are going to buy the book, right? But just like I have a colophon in the back of the book that details all of the tools, all of the cameras that were used, all of the film that was used, the darkroom printing paper that was used, and it also says that it was designed with Affinity. I hope that some people who want to be inspired will pick this book up, flip to the back of that, read that, and they'll be led to shoot with a different film or a different camera, or to use Affinity to see it, because every single bit of output that is put into the world using a thing proves to other people that that is a good choice.
I think your point about access is a really, really key one, actually. And I mean, for me growing up, maybe I had, I was more of a ne'er-do-well perhaps, but for me, Photoshop was kind of shareware, in the sense that a CD came across my desk one day and I just happened to get access. I think it was like Photoshop 1.5 or 1.7, something like that. It was early, like you. And like you, I've struggled with access, and I've worked in open source software, right? So I've done, way back in the day, because we are both Moo alumni, I wrote an article for Canonical, the Linux open source company, when I worked there, about how you could use Inkscape to automatically turn our vector pictograms that we made and lay them out so that you could then produce Moo stickers, little round stickers. And I wrote an article and I linked to it, and it was still on the blog, I think, fairly recently. The layout's maybe broken, the CSS is broken, but you can still find the article. And that was a little bit of automation and stuff. But as you say, if you're using GIMP, if you're using Inkscape, if you're using some of the free tools, they're extremely powerful. Things like Darktable, another example, really, really powerful. But the combination of having to do it differently, for one thing, and also open source, we used to say something in open source, which was that you have these arguments back and forth, but ultimately the person who ships code wins. So on the one hand, with open source, you can scratch your own itch and do whatever you like, and that's a super powerful thing. But on the other hand, it does mean sometimes that when there's a very small group of people contributing to something and they're scratching their own itch, sometimes you just have to like it the way that that person likes it. And that's just kind of the way it is. And I think what's exciting sounding about this is that, as you acknowledge right up front, we go through eras, empires rise and fall, and this is the makings of, this is the way it always is in the beginning. It's the way Firefox was in the beginning. It's the way Chrome was in the beginning. And then over time, they become established and they accumulate cruft. And my hope is that the people working on this at Affinity sound like a small team who are just being allowed to focus and get this done and get this version out the door, and that this might be a magical moment where it all kind of works and is all coming together. Do you feel like there's a small team kind of skunk works mentality behind this project?
I do. And I think, at least for the time being, the team at Serif, the company that makes Affinity, the software, even with, you know, Canva is still the parent company, but Serif is still, you know, operating as Serif from everything I've seen, I think. Or they're a division within Canva. I'm not exactly sure how that breaks down, and it doesn't really matter. The software is kind of Affinity by Canva, I think, at this point. But they're based in Nottingham. They're based in the UK, which I didn't know until the beginning of this year. And I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't know that, because I've known of Serif, the company, for, I think, decades, since, you know, well before they made the Affinity suite. And so it isn't a massive company, and it's a very, you know, efficient team. I'm sure they have extra resources now worldwide on the Canva team, which I think generally helps. You know, we've heard about that with DJI's investment in Hasselblad, right? And there was a lot of worry when that originally happened, because no one knew what that meant. You have a small team in Sweden. How are they going to be affected? Is it going to be a good thing or a bad thing? And ultimately, I think we've seen that it's a good thing so far for Hasselblad. It's not like the entire team's been replaced, but they now have software guidance, especially, that they didn't have before. They have mass production expertise that they didn't have or even necessarily need on any of the electronics, really, before. And Hasselblad still doesn't make the kind of units that Canon or Nikon or Sony make, for instance. But that helps. That knowledge sharing can help. And I think if it's done well, I've seen companies scale poorly and I've seen companies scale really well. If it's done well, what's going to happen with the Canva Serif, you know, relationship, if you think of Serif as a separate team, that team is going to continue making the software that they have become really good at making. Mm-hmm. And that's why I also thought originally, when I'd heard about the acquisition, which was before I knew that Serif was based in the UK, I was like, this is a really smart move, because Canva makes software that does the thing it does really, really well. It has obviously a massive user base, but what it is not is really polished desktop software. And the gap between making software like Canva and making software like the Affinity Suite is huge. It's just totally different types of software, even though they ostensibly make visual output for screen and print, right? But those things have very little in common as far as how they're, those things, meaning that those kind of software platforms have very little in common as far as who they're trying to appeal to and the level of granularity of the work involved, but also kind of online versus offline work. I'm a very big fan of software that allows me to work on a plane without an internet connection. I kind of hate software that forces me to have an internet connection. I don't think any software engineers are listening to this, but just in case there's a photography fan who also works at, you know, any of these platforms, any of these companies that make software that requires you to be online to do creative work, please stop or figure out a way to do local caching and local syncing. This is just, I think the assumption that you can always be connected is incorrect. First of all, it is not going to cover 100% of the use cases. And there are people who will also choose to not be connected. I don't know if it would have come up in conversation with, you did have a conversation with Craig Mott. I'm not hallucinating that.
Yeah.
I know through our own conversations, Craig is a fan of completely disconnecting his router and not having access to the internet in order to do his deep work. And a lot of the time it's the writing work, but I do a similar thing. I like having my Wi-Fi off so that there are no unprompted notifications. I don't have to worry about email. I don't have to worry about any of that. Mm-hmm. So having Affinity software, having software that just runs basically on my computer rather than in a web browser or in a browser wrapper, I think is very important. That's not obviously going to manifestly change the world that Canva exists in, but I think having an option that will eventually more and more become more deeply integrated. Like I do like the idea of people who are, say, working in a marketing department and creating assets and having to use, they're using Canva because that's the thing that everyone else uses and that's what they've learned, and they haven't used any Adobe software, they haven't used any Affinity software. giving them an upgrade path for the people who go, this is really cool, but I want to do more, rather than saying, this is really cool, but Canva has to do more. That would actually be a bad decision product-wise for Canva. You could very easily overcomplicate software like Canva, which only works because it isn't overly complex. It doesn't have 3, 4, 6 tiers of buried menus and options. It doesn't need that. But people like me struggle using Canva for anything when I've had to use it because clients use it, and I go into it and I feel like I'm running around with one hand tied behind my back. And so allowing there to be an in-universe, say, upgrade path that might not even be an upgrade. It's free. There's no barrier to entry. Why shouldn't you download this to your computer as well? And I envision a future that they've kind of alluded to already, that there will be more and more integration that might be round trip, perhaps, which could be even cooler, that you know, there will be some assets you can create in Affinity and then share with a team that's mostly doing output, creating templates, you know, having brand managers or your team's designers making things in a higher end tool with the ability to say that you can change these things in Canva, and then you send that to your team in Canva and they can't break things you don't want them to break. Mm-hmm. That's something that Canva currently doesn't really allow so much. They kind of do, but not the way that they could, because the software isn't really there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I see a lot of, and this comes as well down to access. I think the interpretation of the term access happens in a lot of different forms. Access, that's a financial restriction, hugely important. You know, I'm a big fan of the way a lot of the library system works in the US, for instance, where the main library in Fort Lauderdale, the town I grew up in Florida, has a suite of computers that you can just, with a library card, go in and book time on, and they have, you know, currently they have the Adobe suite. There's no reason budget-wise for those computers to not now have the Affinity app. Yeah. And over time, I think we're going to see that a decision like this, at least it has the potential right now to have greater impact in that way for schools that might not be able to, even on an education license the Adobe Creative Suite.
Yeah.
They don't have to worry about that now. I don't know where that will go, and I'm being very honest here. You know, I know if I were an employee of Affinity, I would not be mentioning Adobe. Like, that would be a four-letter word, right? But I think if we're being honest about the competitive landscape, this is a very real discussion that people have. Professional designers who are making a living making things for print and screen complain to each other about the subscription model that Adobe has. And those are people who can afford it without blinking. They're not going to miss it. But a lot of the time, those are people like me who remember when you bought it once and didn't upgrade it for 2 or 3 years because you didn't have to. And I know that the business discussion of subscription software is a very different thing. We're not here to talk about that. And there are pros and cons. But it is a very real discussion that happens. And I think that what this ever-growing, ever-increasing cost subscription model that it's not just Adobe, a lot of people have, a lot of companies are using, it's not taking into account the eventual entropy, the rules of entropy. Like, there is an endpoint here where people will start pushing back, or they will just have to cut down on it. Banks and credit cards are starting to get really good at highlighting the subscriptions that you have and what all of my banks tell me what my yearly subscription cost is. And that includes all my TV subscriptions. It includes everything else. It includes Amazon Prime, all of that stuff. But when you start seeing that rack up, you've got to take into account, you know, like, the accessibility of that. How much value are you getting for the money that you're outlaying? And it's really interesting to me. Again, I don't have the answers to it, but it is interesting when I hear people who are making plenty of money from their software starting to question the value of that software. Of the software, not the value of the software itself. But I think we all know that if we were using a 5-year-old version of Photoshop, it would still be just fine. And I think that companies need to have answers to that. And the line that Canva has drawn with Affinity being free is just basically saying, here's our answer.
Yeah.
Now it's your turn.
Well, it's very much what Apple did with the OS, right? Back in the day when they decided to just one day make Mac OS free. They were, okay, Microsoft, your move. And so consequently, over time, operating systems have become a thing that you don't pay to upgrade anymore. No one worries about that on their phone. No, you know, there's a version of the, there's a parallel universe where that happened, where you were paying for iOS 26 or, you know, whatever you were doing, like, because it's not impossible. And I think it, the thing you're talking about there is an acknowledgement that actually we've hit a level of acceptable on a bunch of these tools that are established things. It's why Anthropic and ChatGPT and whoever else are spiraling to try and figure out what on earth the AI future, and just holding stuff up and going, is this a thing? Is this something you'd pay for? Because they don't actually know what the product is, and it's not there yet. And I think the what we've seen with Adobe and the fatigue around subscriptions, because I agree with you, paying people to make software is a good idea. Paying people to make good software, even if that software is given away for free, or even if it's open source, is what we found in open source. You have to pay people to make good quality open source software. You have to believe in something and believe for it to exist. And I think the fundamental then becomes, okay, what is the motivation behind it? And it sounds like the motivation behind this from Affinity's perspective is to make the best possible product they can, because this is how they will move a customer from potentially just tinkering with Canva to making great stuff, and you're sort of meeting all of their need. And then over time, I'm sure there will be opportunity for them to monetize and find a way to do stuff, but that they'll do it if they cut their cloth accordingly. The problem, I think, with a lot of these big companies is that they chase scale and they become massive. And so now Adobe can't turn the lights on in their offices around the world for less than a bazillion pounds a day. And that's just like, you've messed up and that was your fault. I feel no sympathy, Adobe, Mark Zuckerberg, like, just name a company that now finds themselves in this situation accidentally. Where they've achieved scale, now what? Like, day that people come for Sam Altman's money will make me so happy. Just because they'll be like, Sam, you promised us God and you built something that can draw me a picture of a wonky dog. And it's just, you know, it's, I see it all over. So I kind of get the vibe that, like, Affinity is maybe doing this right.
Well, it's, and again, there is no right answer, but I feel like when the quality of tools that are accessible achieve some sort of parity, and again, I know we're talking, like, if you can't afford the MacBook that you need to run this stuff, you know, or the PC, right? It's Mac and PC software. Then that's kind of, it's a moot point, right? Accessibility is a chain. But you can buy a used computer for, you know, a pretty good deal, Mac or PC, and it's amazing what you can achieve, right? It's the same with cameras, right? I still have a couple of 5D Mark IIs. They are great cameras within the parameters within which they are still great. They're just as good as they were brand new, and you could shoot a commercial campaign on them. And they're cheap. So, like, I recommend old cameras digitally to people all the time, because they think they need the newest thing, and that's the fault of marketing departments. And the reason that the marketing departments have to do that is generally the fault of capitalism. So we are in a chain, right? Yeah. But I think back to when I started learning about any creative arts, pre-graphic design, when I was painting in my, like, 12, 13, 14 years, and I was using paints and paintbrushes, and they were not free, but they were darn cheap, and enough that my minimal, I didn't even have an allowance. I had to, like, do chores around the neighborhood or stuff to earn some bits of money and things like that. But I could afford paint, and I could afford, like, a canvas or a canvas board. Actually, those were a lot cheaper than stretch canvases. And I could afford pencils and paper. And so the creative acts were free, essentially, or as near to free as they could be. So they were very accessible. And again, you think of schools, you know, even if you can't have that access at home, but you're in school, you will, you know, still generally have access in Western cultures to the basic physical tools.
Yeah.
And more of, you know, schools now will have access to digital tools. But I think, again, that's got to be a thing where the access the access can continue outside of school. Like, it's one thing if you're in university and you have access to a whole suite of high-end computers that have all the best software on them, and then you leave uni and you can't afford any of it on your own, even if you have a laptop or whatever else, right? It's why I like DaVinci, right? DaVinci has a paid version that has extra tools, but DaVinci Resolve being free is amazing. Resolve being free got me into being a paid Resolve customer because I started playing with it over this past summer only. And it did things that Premiere and Final Cut did not do, or did not do the way my brain worked. And then I realized it did some other things better. And then I thought, you know, well, now I want to do some of the stuff that I have to pay for, but it's doing what is free so well that I'm, again, it justified its value to me.
Yeah.
And I think that as a model is much more compelling to me going forward to see. I'd love to see companies building something around that. And I know that that doesn't always work. It doesn't, you know, if someone needs to pay their bills, how do you start building a really great iOS app with one developer or with a team when you're bootstrapping? And yet I have friends who are doing exactly that and have been for years, for decades. Yeah. You build really good software with a really small team. Your overheads are lower. You can achieve more with less. It's doable. Even Adobe traces its origins back to, you know, two brothers building a piece of software.
Yeah, well, and on that, so I'll reference an earlier episode. Doug Menway was a guest of the show, photographed Adobe in the 90s in his book, Fearless Genius. And that is worth looking at because you see the founders of Adobe in that book. And on one of my favorite images in that whole book is Dave Hockney being shown Photoshop for the first time. And he's got his dashand on his knee and his paper in his pocket. And he's just being shown Photoshop and he's just sitting around and they got a photo of him. So I think that's amazing. Why I say, like, empires rise and fall. But there are the world, you know, I'm recording this right now using Rogue Amoeba's excellent audio hijack. That's, you know, Panic is another company. A lot of these companies make stuff for the Mac because they realized that Mac software was a way to also, like, you had people who paid for software who'd been trained to pay for software rather than pirating Photoshop on the Windows side. But no, I can't wait to get my hands on this and play with it. One question, because the majority photography listening audience, as much as they want, you know, obviously to hear Ian wax lyrical about his principles of software development and capitalism, how's the photo editing experience? Because you mentioned to me when we were talking separately before you could say what it was, that one of the things that had got you shooting film a lot was a frustration with the editing process, and you wanted to simplify and streamline your editing process, but that actually this software, it seemed like, was giving you maybe more of what you wanted for tweaking your photos and sort of managing them.
It just feels, I hate feeling like I'm fighting the software, and that's not what you want to feel with any tool, right? You don't want to fight your hardware too. I make my camera decisions based on the cameras that fit in my hand and work with my brain. Like, if I have to be thinking about their use, then it's the wrong tool for me, film or digital. And it's the same with software. So what I've been able to test properly so far on the photo editing side of the new Affinity is great. And, you know, and obviously I've been testing more with that for my own work than I have or than I needed to when building the book for AJ. That was minimal interaction, but also just really slick interaction, which again was cool. I wasn't fighting the tool. The tool was kind of felt like it was trying to do everything it could to help me get in and out and do what I wanted. And that's what we want all the time. I don't like looking at a screen all that often. I judge my days, the success of my days, by how few hours I've had to spend looking at any screen. Because it all, you know, if I'm efficient, I'm getting my work done, and I didn't spend half the day on the screen, that's great. Job well done. And it works really well. There's nothing that I've run into yet that I feel I can't do or can't do easily. And I guess this is such a broad thing because editing, you know, it's not meant to replace Capture One, Lightroom, you know, Bridge, whatever anyone uses for their management. It's not doing that. It's definitely on the editing, retouching, tweaking side. But But I'll say this, even things like adjusting white balance, which was something I very practically had to do, even during the press check, the two-day press check in Denmark at Narayana Press, the night before the press run, I had to make adjustments to 8 images that were final images, but based on the proofs that I'd looked at during that day, there were just 8 of them for some reason weren't feeling as warm as I knew they should be based on what I knew the darkroom prints were. And it's like not a big deal, but what it means is, you know, somewhere between a 1% and 3% boost in the white balance will pretty much solve that. And I confirmed that with the pre-press team there. And being able to do that really easily, we're talking fewer than 10 seconds round trip from finding the image in the layout to going into an edit interface for just the photo that allows me to change that, to saving it, to having the link update. It's really hard to, anyone who has struggled with that or just had to wait for the different things to happen in between, the different stages, launching an app, switching to an app, opening, saving, whatever else. Anyone who's done that will understand that that being faster and just feeling frictionless is a really good thing. So yeah, I think that, and I'm saying this not having played much at all with the vector tools, but I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to explore more of what it can be. They've got this studio kind of concept where there's a layout studio, a pixel studio, and a vector studio, or a photo studio rather. A pixel studio, I think, is the photo editing kind of studio. And so, but you can build your own studio with your own tool sets. And that, from what I've seen, is actually going to be really cool for building contextual tool sets around very specific projects and types of work, which will be really cool. Or I'm already doing some vector work leading into my next book project I'm just going to do all the work in Affinity because it's proving to be really fast. No spinning beach balls.
Imagine
which
that.
Everyone knows is bad. And I'll say this as well, because there's stuff that it's not even, we don't have the time to dive into, but is worth covering and hearing about. I'm working on a full case study, like I mentioned, with the Affinity team of how the whole book came together and my direct experiences, almost tool by tool and step by step, and how they compare and how the, you know, things that saved a ton of time in the process, especially, or things that just were frictionless. And that's going to be material that is put out over the next handful of months. And I'm really excited to be able to do that because it's a way to, obviously on Affinity and Canvas side, it's a way to promote their software. But for me, it's an idea I brought to them. I said, this is a teaching opportunity. And if you're willing to allow me to teach it the way that I would teach it normally, this will be a very honest thing that people can watch, because it's going to be in video form. People can watch and go, okay, no, this isn't a piece of marketing material. It serves the purpose of marketing this, but it is not structured like that. It's not formatted like that. I'm very, very, very firm on that. I'd never say anything that just because like someone wants me to say it. I think that's the fair way of phrasing it. I like to be able to stand by everything I say. So when I say that as a 20 plus year, well, 30 year Adobe user, 20 year plus user of, it's got to be close to 25 years now since InDesign became a thing. Wow. The nerves that I had at the beginning of, I've suggested this, but I think this might also be a bad idea to produce a book on untested software. It just completely vanished and disappeared. And it became such a fast process that I was able to, this is the ultimate measure for me. And like the last word I'll say on it is that I was able to get into flow when I needed to be in flow and the software didn't interrupt me. Once I had kind of acclimated to the things that were different, I was able to get into flow. And that's the measure for me with any tool, pen, pencil, paper, clay, Play-Doh, you know, whiteboard marker or software. And it makes me excited to do more with it.
Okay, well, I can't wait to get my hands on it. Obviously, I will have to wait like the rest of us. By the time this comes out, it will be available to download and play with. And I will be sticking it on my computers at Windows and Mac and seeing what I can do and tinker with it, because I'd love to be able to edit photos properly. Lightroom on my laptop. My laptop was a very cheap purchase. It's an older laptop, and it's a Windows one, and it cannot edit photos. So I'm going to see if just some fresh software that doesn't need, you know, have as much cruft in it can actually get out of its own way and let me tweak with stuff when I travel. Well, that's brilliant. Well, thank you for coming back on, Dan. That was excellent.
Thank you for having me, and it's always a pleasure. Oh, I should probably mention the book itself, so people don't have to go back. I mean, they should go back and listen to last week's episode, but the book title is It Feels Like the Beginning Again. It's by A.J. Woomer. Andrew Joseph on the mm-hmm. cover of the book, but A.J. Woomer, phenomenally talented photographer and just wonderful human. He's also a musician, totally different thing. Go look up his work, ajwoomer.com. Or on Instagram. He's a really good friend as well, but his work that he's done for this book over nearly 5 years of photographing in Copenhagen, when he's from Miami, so that is a big part of the story. It's a wonderful collection of work, and it will be a source of inspiration to photographers everywhere, I think.
Yes. I've had a sneak peek. Very lucky to get a really quick, easy export of a PDF, in fact, from you. So I can have a look through it while I wait for my copy to arrive. But yeah, I it's really good. It's well worth a look. He's not bad, I suppose. We'll say that without him here. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Dan. Have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. You too.